This is Jason Halsey. This is not exactly the Liminalist. This is a special Liminalist release thing to announce the next Liminalist live event meeting on the 21st of December 2019 at 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, which would be 2 p.m. Eastern, and it would be 7 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time. It's by donation, and if you'd like to attend, you need to go to the website and go to the console or contact tab in the menu bar and follow the steps there. There's a little form that you need to fill out. That's about all I need to say about the event. I think it's participatory, and it's on Zoom, and you need a microphone and a video camera if you want to participate, but participation is not obligatory. I'm going to share a sample of the last event from 2 weeks ago. Although the events are recorded, I won't be generally sharing them, but this is just the intro of me talking, so it doesn't involve anyone else who was there, and rest assured that these are private events and I won't be making them public unless there's a general desire to do so of those involved. Probably won't surprise many of you or any of you that I've been wondering why I'm doing this today, then thinking about the difference between self-doubt and a real question, a non-rhetorical question: why am I doing this today? What is the actual purpose? And the last thing I ended up on was community, and that seems to be the answer as to why I'm doing this. It's because I'm looking for community. As for why I'm looking for community, that's the deeper question. Like, what does community mean? I know the theme for today, well, the main theme was going beyond the threshold of theory, but I was doing a play on words there with theory of mind and the way in which we seem to be unable to interact with other people without this theory of mind, this idea we have about the other. The other that is out there, and how we interact with that theory rather than with the other directly, and that itself prevents us from having a full experience of ourselves. There's a kind of vicious circle in that, because we have a theory about the other and how the other perceives us, that makes us more self-conscious. But also it causes us to be interacting with this imaginary other rather than directly with the other. And there's a vicious circle in this, which I have not yet been able to break out of, which is that the mind itself comes about via theory of mind. At least this is the biological model, that because at a certain point in our survival, we began to imagine what the other might be thinking in order to try and anticipate and preempt them, or do what we thought was necessary to get what we wanted from them. And that by doing that, that gave rise to our own awareness or sense or idea of ourselves as existing separately from the other. So it's like our own mind self came into being as a kind of mirroring of this theory we had about the mind of the other. And then that snowballed, if you will, that became more and more fixed. So the more we imagined what the other was thinking, the more we were thinking, the more we became trapped in this theory of our own mind in the theoretical realms of being. So as some of you know, I always like to make the medium come as close to the message as possible. Another way of saying is to be meta, or to bring it into the room, to be commenting on what's actually happening here. And what's actually happening here, wherever here is at any given time, I think always represents, it always serves not just as a lived reality, but as a metaphor for something else. And in this camp, perhaps because we are also elsewhere in a certain sense, where we're both in this dissociated mind realm and in the physical lived life, bringing the two together is like bringing the metaphor together with the reality. And in this case, what I'm doing now in the setup is a metaphor for what I'm talking about, because right now we've got point to many transmission. I was going to check on the exact terminology, but when radio was invented, it was a military operation, because it was military technology and it was psychological operations even, and it was sort of came out of the discovery of a very obvious deduction or realization that point to point radio, as in one person talk communicating with another on radio, could become point to many communication, which would be broadcast radio, public radio, and this would be a tool for dissemination of propaganda. So yeah, right now what I've got going on is point to many communication. There's one person transmitting and many are listening, and you're in the passive role and I'm in the active role. And I think that's basically an unnatural setup, but it's one that's become endemic or systemic in our culture. We just recognize it as fairly normal. I want, or at least partly, I want to reverse that so that it's, I don't know, actually. I'm not quite sure how it will play out. But I mean, in obvious ways, you know, everybody can talk and then it's many to many, many points to point. But there's another way of looking at it, which is that there are different ways of transmitting. So although it seems as though I'm in the active role and I'm transmitting some message or meaning or information to you and you're all sitting passively receiving that, which would be the model for propaganda, essentially, even if it's benign propaganda. The potential here is for you to be transmitting to me many to point and me to be receiving that and articulating it or echoing it back to you. And I think that that's the positive function of having any kind of setup of a point to many setup, as in one person talking and the other's receiving, is that at a deeper level, if it's working, it's the other way around. I'm receiving and transmitting, but you're all transmitting also and receiving. It's just that only one of us is articulating. And this is where community comes in, is that for each of us to have an experience of ourselves requires an experience of the other or a connection to the other. And the other is many. Like each of us as an identity, we experience ourselves as one in relation to many. There may be, we may prefer one-to-ones, as I always have, but there are still many one-to-ones. We don't just relate to one person. We relate to a series of others, collectively or individually, one by one. And it was occurring to me last night, I was making these notes, which hopefully I won't actually have to refer to because that would be very bookish, but that who I think I am is very much the result of a lifetime of interactions with others. I've got this database of memories of interacting with others. And in each interaction, I experience myself in different ways. And then that goes into my data bank, and then that becomes part of my identity. So how valid is that? Well, it would depend on how real those interactions were. I think as with all things, the thing that traps us can also be the thing that frees us. So I think although we are collectively and individually trapped by our theory of mind about one another and all of our recorded into the body, really, And they began with traumatic imprints, interactions with the other that were traumatic. And they got imprinted in our bodies as these memories of the other that become the script that tell us who we are and who we want to be and the ways that we can behave, the ways that we need to behave to get what we want and all of that stuff. The way to undo that script is to, I mean, this is actually basic psychotherapy or one of the, I don't know exactly which one, but to reprogram oneself, I don't like computer language, but to retrain oneself by having positive experiences with the other to cancel out and neutralize the negative experiences we had that were formative of the other. But I think it goes much further and much deeper in terms of who we actually are. We're not actually just a self in relation to a series of others. We're something much more than that. But I'm not entirely sure if I can articulate that, what we are, with certainly not without going New Agey, which I don't want to do. Point is that I'm, on the surface level, I'm checking and keeping an eye on all of you, as it were. It's probably not the right phrase, but I'm trying to stay aware of all of you individually. And at a deeper level, I'm also tuning into you, which I'm not doing. It's not a doing, but it's happening. And I'm aware of it in a, again, in this mixed way of, is this a genuine question or is this self-doubt? Because I'm aware of a certain level of skepticism or uncertainty or what, you know, what's he saying now? And is he going to be making sense? Is, whatever. I mean, some of that's going to be my own theory and some of it's genuine. But so far as it's genuine, it's a visceral, bodily a reception. I'm receiving your transmissions individually and collectively. And kind of surfing it. It's like swimming or something of that kind. And as I say, obviously, this isn't something I can do mentally. It's not a mental operation. But what I am doing here, at the very least, is speaking. And speaking does require using my mind. I mean, I'm using language and I have to keep referring to my mind to speak. So that is tricky because my mind is been configured in such a way that it's identified with the self, with a theory about itself based on all of these past experiences and imprints and relationships with the other. And I don't want, and you don't want to me to be communicating to you from that, from the mind, because we won't, nothing new. Yeah, like, was it? Where was it? Jerusalem. Nothing good comes out of the mind. But it has to come through the mind if it's going to be language. Anyway, what was my point here? That there's something collective is happening here. Even at the most superficial level, something collective is happening. But at the deeper level, also something collective is happening. And although I'm not quite sure how I will articulate this, that something collective that is happening has to do with us being a collective, a collective being. Again, even at a superficial level, that's true. We are collectively being together, so we are being a collective right now. We're almost seemingly almost arbitrarily gathered together on Zoom. Obviously, it's not arbitrary because you're drawn by what I do, but still, so we're at that level, we're being together on Zoom, but that may imply something else that's what I termed a collective being. I like the play on words here, because I'm not actually getting mystical unless you want me to. This is a collective being. Sam's shaking his head, he's probably saying, I'm being too pedantic here, I don't know. But anyway, it is there is an opportunity in this, which is to discover who we are. That's the bottom line. And I experienced that by finding a new way of being in the experience of collective being. And that two things become inseparable. That, like, me being able to articulate things that are going to be helpful and meaningful to you, so that you know, I won't say get your money's worth, that would be a bit crass, but that your being here is justified. That is inseparable from me having the experience that I'm seeking, which is I come a little bit closer to discovering who I am. So see the paradox in that, or whatever you want to call that, that I can only discover who I am through interaction with others. The implication to me is that who I am is found in others. Like, I am located in you, and you are located in me. It's a little bit gospel-like, actually.
Wake up, wake up! Wake up, wake up! Wake up, wake up! Wake up, wake up! Wake up!
And a stone in my shoe, and you love it. There's a spot on your nose and a stain on your shirt, and I love it. There's a spot on your nose and a stain on your shirt, and you hate it. There's a bone in my fish and a hole in my jeans, and I hate it. There's a bone in my fish and a hole in my jeans, well, who cares? There's a smile on your face when you tell me goodbye, 'cause you love it. There's a smile on your face when you tell me goodbye, and I hate it.
Okay, once again, Limitless Meet, Saturday 21st of December. I've got a lisp, 21st of December at 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, 7 p.m. Greenwich Mean Time. I'm just going to maybe read a little bit now, just to make this a little more substantial as a podcast, from today's blog post, which is about the HBO show Watchmen, which I watched recently and found to be quite a grueling experience, but I suppose educational, and it did inspire a, I guess, 4,000 or so word piece. Definitely helped me to understand the sociocultural engineering agenda of intersectionality, critical theory, identity politics, multiculturalism, and all of that stuff, and how the ideology is extending itself through the popular media. Quite a few levels and layers to this. So I'm going to read a segment from that piece, and if you want to read the whole thing, then you could just find it at the website. This is from the section titled Decentering Whiteness. To give an idea about the sort of progressive ideology which the Watchmen show is platforming, the following is from White Silence's Violence at LA Progressive, the online site for the Left Coast Forum, a covening of progressive activists, scholars, organizers, documentarians, media organizations, and others who work to understand and restructure systems of oppression. Quote, invisibility gives white supremacy power. Call it out. Use white privilege to interrupt white supremacy, to dismantle white supremacy, to take a back seat and support others who have been oppressed by white supremacy, to give those who have been oppressed by white supremacy opportunities they have been denied, and to learn from those who have been oppressed by white supremacy. And use your privilege to listen. America has a system that has been built around making space for, centering, and hearing white voices above others, and it is time for us to be quiet and really listen. It's also time for white people to understand that all lives can't matter until black lives matter too. End quote. I didn't mean to ham it up there, but I couldn't help myself. In the interest of decentering whiteness, Watchmen makes its black character central to the story, and then it makes their blackness central to their identity. Yet besides the revenge fantasy elements, the show doesn't seem to me like it would particularly appeal to black people. In contrast to Atlanta, a show I very much enjoyed, Watchmen is a show about black people that seems mainly to have been made for white people, yet not for white or black fans of the graphic novel. If memory serves, mainly because it was faithful to the genre conventions, the only black characters in the comic book are the news vendor and Rorschach's psychiatrist. That would be unthinkable for a 2019 American mainstream TV show, however, and would even make it ineligible for funding. But then I would guess that any big-budget multiracial drama produced in the US today would have to make racial injustice central to its premise in order to get made. White decentricists all, Lindelof, that's Damon Lindelof, the showrunner, and co, are dutifully conscientious in placing non-white characters front and center in their narrative. They have invented a lead character who is both black and female, Angela Abar, and in case that's not enough, they have transformed two of the original characters from white to black, hey presto, via the deus ex machina of the presiding liberal superconscience. Yet, token black writers and directors notwithstanding, these characters are invented and reinvented by white liberals who, I presume, sincerely believe in their social justice mission to restore racial balance and equality. Central to this mission is the affirmation of black grievance and the manufacturing of black revenge fantasies. For what better way to move the black man and woman to the center than to emphasize their victim status? Ironically, this may be a predominantly white perspective of what being black means. Kids with matches. In episode 6, this extraordinary being, Hooded Justice, is revealed to be a black bisexual man as a way to more firmly establish the show's whole cloth reinvention of the source material as primarily about racial inequality and violence. The original Watchmen wasn't concerned with what it meant to be black or white, but what it meant to be human. Watching the orgiastic scenes of black justice in which the beaten down cop kills the evil white supremacist bent on turning blacks into rioting savages via mind control technology, I said to my wife, are they trying to start a race war? In case the reader is wondering, I wasn't referring to the evil white supremacists in the show, but to the creators of it. What better way to foment racial violence than to play upon, pump up, and cynically exploit black people's feelings of injustice, and then offer a fetishized fantasy template for violent revenge? Is this how a culture commits harikari, suicide by oppressed minority? In my experience, what happens when black characters are conceived and represented by mostly white privileged progressives with good intentions is that an aura of righteous indignation and progressive satisfaction transfers from the writers to the characters. One consequence of this is that it makes those characters seem overly strident and slightly repellent. HBO's Watchmen seems designed to play on both white guilt and black outrage. Watching it as a white man, I found myself wondering if my reaction to these characters, my finding them slightly repellent, made me a racist too. unconscious racism has to be rooted out. The show is even savvy enough to have a couple of jokes about it. But what repelled me about them wasn't their blackness. It was because they are avatars for a Molotov cocktail of liberal white guilt and cynical corporate opportunism. The new black heroes conceived by mostly white progressives are a bit like reverse Uncle Toms. Their main function is to affirm white guilt. But pride and shame are two sides of the same coin, and by turning shame into virtue, progressives have started taking pride in their shame, maybe so they never have to feel ashamed again. By placing the oppressed black person in the center of their white guilt fantasies, they recruit him once again into an age-old agenda of narcissistic self-regard. Worse, they turn the black man into a mirror image of themselves. This is most fully and shamelessly revealed in the episodes in which Dr. Manhattan, the superhero we have been waiting 5 episodes to see, regains his humanity. These shark-jumping episodes depict how, out of love for the noble black woman, Dr. Manhattan chooses to forget himself and become fully human. Why does he do this? Mainly because his godliness has started annoying his woman. How does he accomplish it? By the ironically quite Christian feat of resurrecting the body of a black man and entering into it. So it is that Dr. Manhattan regains his humanity, A, by becoming a romantic hero, and B, by transforming into a black man with a very large schlong. Talk about runaway white progressive fantasies. Watchmen is the ultimate intersectionality morality play in which the superior white man, East Coast blue blood patriarch, chooses to become a black stay-at-home dad. Still insufficiently humbled, however, he's still a man, face it. He then hands over his power to the woman, in the form of the magic egg he leaves for his wife, and willingly opts for self-abnegation, dissolution. It's the superhero genre equivalent of Noam Baumbach's superior soap opera Marriage Story, in which the husband and father, played by Adam Driver, has to be literally brought to his knees and then become prostrate on the kitchen floor before his submission to the woman's desire is complete. Only then can he be redeemed and relocate to Los Angeles to support her TV career. Watchmen is a motley collection of self-castigating, self-glorifying fantasies of mostly white, privileged progressives of both sexes, and so naturally the same class of people are now praising the show to the heavens, with or without directly referring to its intersectional transubstantiation miracles. Online audience ratings are roughly half the critic ratings, however, around 50% in favour or against. And naturally, critics are trying to blame the discrepancy on review bombing by disgruntled fans or white supremacists. Even if this is partially true, doesn't it still indicate the level of displeasure the show has caused people? I feel like review bombing this show myself, not least because of the crazy amount of praise it's been receiving. The attribution of viewer displeasure to ideological differences is yet more evidence of ideological possession at work, as if the only reason to object to being propagandized by a TV show is disagreement with the ideology being pushed. This is common to those who believe they're on the winning side of history. They don't see their viewpoint as ideological, only as true. So if you find the Watchmen show ideologically top-heavy, the problem is in you, dear viewer, not the stars. You are probably a right-wing troll. Another significant distinction from the comic book is especially ironic considering the show's seemingly leftist slant. While superficially critical of the mass vigilante, the Watchmen show seems to implicitly signal us to trust in authority. This contradiction may be at the heart of the new leftist progressive mindset, which is becoming more and more compatible with, even indistinguishable from, authoritarianism. The white male patriarchy is the source of all the world's problems, sure, but the institutions it has built, the edifices of power, are basically sound and just need to be populated and managed by the right minorities. The center remains the same, it is only who gets placed there that needs to change. Now the white male is out of power, the black female empowered, the ship of state can be steered steadily towards justice, unhooded. The new leftist position, as it comes closer and closer to narrative dominance, is that there is nothing wrong with state power or police action as long as the right people are behind it. The original Watchman questioned the use of force to solve problems and suggested that the will to power, becoming superhuman, was sourced in trauma and neurosis and the root of greater evils to come. It was never suggested as a cure for it. The TV version manages somehow to have it both ways. It eschews the need for masks, vigilantism, and it soft questions the use of force. But at the same time, it presents force, authority, power, as necessary to restore balance, equality, and justice to the world. The ethos has come full circle from right is might to might is right all over again. There is nothing wrong with shooting, just so long as the right people get shot. Poor Alan Moore may have no clue as to what his playing in the superhero sandpit has wrought. David Gibbons has his name on the show, however. He should know better. HBO's Watchmen is a counterfeit. Like all counterfeits, it superficially resembles what it counterfeits, which is what makes it fundamentally cynical and exploitative. There seems to be a correlation between a culture that has become increasingly secular and hence nihilistic, and the narcissism of its makers. What happens, apparently, is that the culture makers, formerly artists, lose focus on their interior life, where inspiration happens, and their gaze moves progressively over to the world, to society, where all values are now sourced. As a result, art, so-called, is no longer about articulating the still silent voice within us, or giving voice to the soul. It is about addressing social injustices in the world in order to be relevant and radical. Yet I doubt there is any way to be radical if your only frame of reference is social justice, because at that point the creative process becomes all about reacting to what's already there in the world, instead of discovering what's latent within you. And being radical suggests introducing something that is new into the mix, surely, rather than merely reacting to the old. Lindelof's Watchmen wants to be art that is making the world a better place by addressing the injustices of the world. What it is, what Lindelof is one more reactionary sock puppet for the dominant ideology of critical theory, identity politics, grievance studies. By relating primarily to the past, by reacting to the manufactured shadow realities of empire, it has achieved the aims of propaganda, and propaganda, no matter its spin, is always in service of empire. But deep down, I suspect Lindelof's aim isn't really to change the world so much as it is to improve his position in the world, and that of his favourite minorities, of course. These days, this is largely achieved by asserting an identity, such as the making the world a better place identity. It is the new age of the social justice narcissist, and Watchmen, the TV show, as loving defilement, is perhaps the fullest and most depressing expression of the new ethos of virtue signalling. All signal, no virtue. Well, I rushed through that. I didn't want to do the whole article because I wanted to leave something for people to actually read the site. It's a creed occur, not exactly a lion's roar, or maybe not quite saying no in thunder, but I am saying no in my little way to this TV show. I suppose, by extension, all TV shows I probably should know better. But right now I'm still hooked to that hopeless little tube, to quote somebody else that I think is an unreliable witness. And so as long as I am, I might as well use it as a scrying mirror to diagnose a terminally sick culture. What happens to vultures that live on the carrion of poisoned corpses? Probably not good. But, you know, small doses, it's an emetic, flushes out the system. That's really what we're doing here. Ideally, well, hopefully, with the grace of God, we're using exposure to the world as an emetic or an enema to flush out the world that has been installed in us, which is the very thing that prevents us from turning away from the world. So it's really about just becoming more and more delicately aware of that Chinese finger trap for our perception and awareness that is HBO and all related engines of corporocultural propaganda by the narcissoliberal progressive elite. Okay, this has been a sort of podcast and a sort of YouTube video as just a way of using this multimedia platform while it's here and while it's still reasonably uncensored to get the word out. If you haven't seen Watchmen, don't. If you have, and even if you haven't, share this video, podcast, or blog article to let people know just how thoroughly they've been conned and maybe help them to develop the tools to prevent it from happening next time. Till next time, I am Jason Horsley at horticulture.com, the Limitless. If you'd like to support me, some of you already know how. Those who don't, just go to the website and look for the flower in the sidebar that says donate or buy one of the books that are there. Vice of Kings, Prisoner Infinity, Seen and Not Seen, Dark Oasis, and a bunch of juvenilia that I'm a little bit embarrassed by. I can't really fully recommend. Or just go out and enjoy nature and send your happy thoughts my way.
Changes in the heart, change with the times. Strangers in the night, pass up and downtown. Changes in your soul, they happen all the time. Changes in the heart, change with the times. Strangers in the night, change with the times. Dangers in the dark, pass up and downtown. Changes in your soul, they happen all the time. Strangers in the dark, change with the times. And all the little sins, all the letdowns and wins, the things you begin with, the things that you end with, the changes in the heart, change with the times. Changes in the heart, change with the times. Strangers in the night, pass up and downtown. Changes in your soul, they happen all the time. Changes in the heart, change with the times. All the little sins, all the letdowns and wins, the things you begin with, the things that you end with, changes in the heart, change with the times. Changes in the stars, change with the night. Strangers in the heart, stay up until light. Dangers in your soul.